The United States calls on Russia to stop transferring Ukrainians from Russian-occupied parts of Ukraine into Russian territory. Our reporter tells us why some Ukrainians had no choice other than escaping to Russia.
For them, there was a decision made while they were running on the street, trying to find any safety they could.
Plus, Russia and Ukraine hold rare talks in Turkey to try to end a Russian blockade of Ukrainian grain exports that is worsening hunger in Africa. And later in the program, we'll tell you about an 11-year-old American raising awareness about Russia's war on Ukraine by hosting his own news program.
And then when the actual invasion happened, I knew I had to do something to help, so I began making reports on that as well.
Today is Wednesday, July 13th. From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Ukraine. Good evening, I'm Michael Lippin, filling in for Steve Miller. Ukrainian and Russian officials met face-to-face Wednesday for the first time in months. Military delegations from the two sides held rare talks in the Turkish city of Istanbul to negotiate a potential deal to end a Russian blockade of Ukrainian food exports from Ukraine's Black Sea ports. UN officials also were involved in that meeting. Ukraine is one of the world's largest exporters of wheat, corn, and sunflower oil, but Russia's full-scale invasion of the country has disrupted Ukrainian production and halted shipments. The International Committee of the Red Cross says disruptions to global food supplies and increases in fuel prices related to the war in Ukraine are exacerbating severe hunger in parts of Africa. Lisa Schlein has the story from Geneva.
The ICRC warns Africa's food crisis is set to worsen. It says conflict and armed violence, failing harvest due to years of drought, and increases in food and other commodity prices are driving more people into extreme poverty and hunger. A recent UN assessment estimates 346 million people on the continent face severe food insecurity, meaning one quarter of the population does not have enough to eat. The ICRC Regional Director for Africa, Patrick Youssef, says the situation is urgent. He warns many lives will be lost without a concerted effort by different actors to meet the challenges ahead. He says aid agencies, international financial institutions, and governments must collaborate to prevent the humanitarian crisis from becoming irreversible.
As we look at 2023, we know that this will repeat itself. These climate shocks will repeat themselves. The food insecurity will remain as acute as it is. It will not end with a calendar year. So we are better collectively to be prepared for a long haul, for a crisis that will certainly increase in size and volume.
The ICRC reports the war in Ukraine has caused a sharp increase in fuel and fertilizer prices. That, it says, has added significant pressure on farmers, many of whom are weathering the combined impact of conflicts and climate shocks. Youssef says the Horn of Africa is most seriously affected. He notes, however, that other parts of Africa, from Mauritania to the Sahel to Lake Chad, and to a lesser extent, the Central African Republic, are suffering from the effects of the Ukraine crisis.
Countries are equally hit, at least those who are, as you mentioned, sir, dependent on grains and wheat from Russia and Ukraine. Somalia is the worst, 90%. But Nigeria has also a large dependency on that, Sudan and South Sudan as well. And indeed, the situation is extremely difficult for people that are inaccessible for humanitarian organizations such as Somalia.
Youssef says lack of access to people in areas affected by conflict and armed violence, such as Somalia and Burkina Faso, raise the challenges to a different level. The ICRC reports more than 35 armed conflicts are taking place on the continent, and around 30 million people are internally displaced and refugees. The Swiss-based humanitarian agency says people uprooted from their homes are particularly vulnerable to extreme weather, fluctuation of food prices, and hunger. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
As battles rage in Ukraine's east and south, its foreign minister, Dmytro Kuleba, is ruling out ceding any territory to Russia should peace talks resume. VOA sister network RFERL says Kuleba told a Wednesday press briefing that Ukraine's war objective is to liberate its territories and restore Ukrainian sovereignty to eastern and southern regions occupied by Russia. Kuleba also said Ukraine needs faster deliveries of Western military aid. AP's Charles de Ledesma has more.
Military support from Western countries has been key to Ukraine's surprising success against larger and better equipped Russian forces. But still, Kuleba says more weapons are needed.
The deliveries of weapons have to be sped up. And all our friends and partners know that. Many are working to make it happen.
Kuleba stresses Ukraine wants peace, but that it was up to Russia to show that they do too. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
A senior Russian official told a Russian news site earlier this month that Moscow has not been deploying its military forces internationally in a way that threatens the U.S. and its allies. VOA fact-checking team Polygraph.info examined that assertion in this report written by Leonid Martinyuk and narrated by William Eccles.
Russian Deputy Foreign Minister Alexander Grushko claimed that Russia has not expanded its military presence abroad and blamed NATO for shattering relations. It's NATO that is imposing it on us. We are not expanding. We are not setting up our bases somewhere. That is false. Since 2008, Russia has established at least 26 military bases abroad. After the 2008 Russo-Georgian War, Russia turned the CIS Peacekeepers Training Center in Guldata, Georgia, into a full-fledged military base. In 2009, Russia established the 4th military base for troops stationed in the occupied Georgian region of South Ossetia. In 2014, Russia illegally annexed Crimea from Ukraine, then built new military bases on the peninsula. Russia revived Soviet radar stations in Crimea and used air bases there to strike Ukraine. By November 2021, Russia had established 10 military bases in occupied eastern Ukraine. Russia has established new military bases in 6 Ukrainian regions it has occupied. In February, Russia launched missile and airstrikes on Ukraine from military bases in Belarus. In July, Belarus's Zyabrakovka airfield was converted into a new Russian military base. Since late 2017, Russia has used the Kamima military base in Syria as its main platform to intervene in that country's civil war.
You can find more VOA fact checks online at the website polygraph.info. You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. I'm Michael Lippin. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken issued a statement Wednesday calling on Russia to immediately stop what he called the forced deportations of Ukrainians from Russian-occupied parts of Ukraine into Russia itself. Blinken said the unlawful transfer of people is a grave breach of the 4th Geneva Convention on the Protection of Civilians, and it is a war crime. Blinken said estimates from multiple sources indicate that Russian authorities have forcibly deported between 900,000 and 1.6 million Ukrainian citizens, including 260,000 children. Many of those people have been put through what Moscow calls filtration procedures in both Russia and Russian-occupied Ukraine to try to weed out anyone seen as a threat. VOA Ukrainian service journalist Tatiana Vorosko wrote about this phenomenon in a story published on voanews.com on July 6th. I spoke to her about the story and asked what she learned regarding why so many Ukrainians went to Russia in recent months.
So I would say there are maybe three categories of people, of Ukrainians who end up in Russia. Some people obviously go willingly. They might have relatives in Russia. They might be early during the conflict. They were pro-Russian. They decided they would go. There were numerous reports about forced deportations. I did not look into those. I looked in the third category of people, focused on that part of the story, of people who had to go to Russia because they simply had no other choice. Two families I talked to are both from Mariupol, and they left about the same time, March 1920. They were in shelter for about 3 weeks under heavy shelling. They had their food was running out. They had no electricity. And one of the biggest challenges was access to water. They were running out of water, or getting the water was extremely risky. They were cold, they were scared, and also they did not have information. Ukrainian government is saying that like a lot of evacuation routes were disrupted. They tried to evacuate people from Mariupol, from other cities, and we all saw this all over the news, and they could not do that. The evacuation routes were disrupted. Even though routes which were successful, many people did not know about that. One of the issues they talk about was information, how they can get out of Mariupol, how they can get to safety. In both cases, they find out about the evacuation organized by Russians from passerbys, from people on the street. So they just, for them, there was a decision made while they were running on the street, trying to find any safety they could. So they both cases they were taken to the Donetsk to Donetsk Oblast, which is under Russian occupation, temporarily occupied territories. They were settled there in, you know, some at the school or some other area. Mostly at the, so they settled them at the school. And in both cases, in one case, they crossed into Russia because they were told to wait for filtration, and they thought they would rather go to Russia. In the second case, they were just on the run. So they crossed the border with Russia and immediately began to get out of the country, immediately began moving to the western border.
Yeah, so in your story, you did speak to some of those Ukrainians who did want to get out of Russia pretty fast, and they were able to do so. How was that?
So in their cases, they in one case, they arrived to Taganrog, and they were a group of 9 people. They stayed with the person they knew, somebody who left Mariupol before them, and then the group separated. So some of the group stayed behind in Russia. 4 people stayed behind in Russia. 5 people left, and some to Estonia and some to Finland. So they were just taking buses, taking trains, taking taxis. They're asking for help, but they had documents. So they were able to arrive to the border. And then they were crossing the border. This young man I talked to, he was telling me about pretty hard questioning he was subjected to. For 6 hours, he was asked questions. Russian border personnel was looking at his phones, verifying information about him. So there was very, it's like he was telling me there was a very traumatic experience for him. But eventually he was allowed to cross the border.
So Tatiana, some Ukrainians have had a much tougher time getting out of Russia. Why is it that it is more difficult for those people?
There are 3 major problems which Ukrainians experience in Russia. So first of all, it's a lack of cash. They might not have money. In one case, the person I talked to, he told me that during filtration, one of the person in his group was, you know, they just took his money. So they arrived to Russia sometimes with very little cash. And they just, you know, just travel, it becomes very difficult. Russian organizations, volunteer organizations, they do help with that. They told me that they buy tickets, they help with hotels, they help with information. The Red Cross is also helping with the cash. Maybe Russian government, they provide some of the money for settling, but it's like the cash, like the money is one of the biggest issues. The second issue is if people take in very far east. I talked to Alexandra Matvichuk, who is a human rights lawyer. She told me like about some cases. For example, a family is taken to Vladivostok on Russian Far East, and he doesn't have documents, and she just gave a baby. She just had a baby, or they were about to have a baby. So then people don't have documents. And if they're taken too far away, that'd be like the logistics, the travel through Russia becomes very difficult. And also if people have, for example, they left their homes in a hurry, they don't have their documents, or they lost their documents on the way, or they just have babies, and babies don't have any documents. So living Russia without documents is very complicated. It's very difficult. And that's one of the points of my piece, how to get out if you don't have them.
Just one more thing I wanted to ask you, which is what the Ukrainian government is doing to try to help its citizens who have ended up in Russia?
Yes, that's they are obviously aware of the situation. They know that, they work with that. So, but we have to understand that Ukraine doesn't have embassy in Russia, and in March they closed all their consulates. So the Ukrainian government does not have any representation in Russia. So what they tell people if they have those problems, if they need a document, they need to contact the Ukrainian embassies in the countries where they're trying to go. Mostly those are neighbor countries, like if they want to go to Georgia or they're going to go to Lithuania, Estonia, they need to contact Ukrainian consulates in those countries, and they will work on each case separately. And I talked to the speaker of Minister of Foreign Affairs, and he told me that those cases might be quite difficult because a person might not have the documents with him or with her, but also the database, the documentation where we can verify it is on the territory of which is a temporary occupied by Russians. It's in control of Russia, so it's difficult for them to get to those documents. So the Ukrainian government, they obviously, the diplomats, the consular workers, they help on case-by-case basis. But they also currently, the government is developing new ways to ease the documentation of those people, to provide them with some sort of the documents, which will be some sort of like a temporary travel document, can be used in this capacity. So just to leave Russia to the third country or cross to Ukraine and then work on recovering the documentation. And also they're looking for a way for a third country, maybe help Ukraine with the consulate services in Russia.
VOA Ukrainian Service journalist Tatiana Vorosko, thank you so much for speaking to Flashpoint Ukraine about your recent story.
Thank you.
For millions of Ukrainians who fled Russia's full-scale invasion earlier this year, neighboring Poland was their first destination. From there, many Ukrainian refugees moved on to other countries or later returned home. Others have decided to stay in Poland, where they find a welcoming environment that also puts them very close to their homeland, as Greg Flakus found out on a visit to the Polish border town of Medyka.
Ukrainians have been coming to Poland for decades to work and study, so it's a natural destination for refugees from the war. 18-year-old Julia is one recent arrival.
I want to study in Poland, and to maybe make study and job to earn money. We must help our parents in Ukraine.
She's learning Polish, but she plans to return to Ukraine as soon as the war ends.
Because it's our country, it's our home, and we want to return.
But danger stops many from returning. After fleeing a war zone in eastern Ukraine, Sophie embraces life in Poland.
I'm so like Polish. I even have like Polish, my favorite, yeah. I so like Polish guy because they really understand us. They really try to help us.
According to the United Nations, close to 7 million refugees left Ukraine in the first weeks of the war. More than 2 million have returned to their homeland. 4 million Ukrainians crossed into Poland, and more than a million have stayed. While some refugees welcome the chance to live in prosperous Western European nations, many ignore offers of free transportation to those more distant lands, according to Agnieszka Kosiewicz of the Polish Migration Forum, an NGO that promotes the rights of migrants.
Right now we do have trains and buses that leave to those countries empty or half empty because there is no interest to move on among the refugees.
Similarities in language and culture attract Ukrainians to Poland, but Kosiewicz says proximity to their homeland is most important. The drive back to their land was especially strong during the spring planting season, says Kosiewicz.
And a lot of people need to plant things in the gardens in order to have crops. We also see people going for visits to see whether their house is still there or in what shape is the farm.
Even some Ukrainians whose homes are not currently in active combat zones have chosen to stay in Poland, hoping that maybe soon they'll be able to return to their neglected gardens and fields. Greg Flakus for VOA News, Medica, Poland.
An 11-year-old California boy who has a Ukrainian mother is doing his part to raise awareness about Ukraine's plight by hosting his own news program on YouTube. You might think Arthur Brooke is a little young to be reporting the news, but he's already been doing it for 5 years with a little help from his older sister Sophia and their father Jonathan. Kristina Shevchenka saw them in action and produced this story narrated by Anna Rice.
Russian dictators have been trying to wipe out Ukrainian culture and language. But more than culture and language, it's our freedom that...
This is Arthur Brooke Reports, a YouTube channel that covers the latest events in Ukraine. It was started by an 11-year-old California boy.
You're watching The Worldview with Arthur, and I'm Arthur Brooke.
The YouTube channel, with just under 300 subscribers, covers news relating to Ukraine and the activities of volunteers from the Ukrainian diaspora in California. Interviews, analysis, fundraising, it has it all. Arthur hosts his show wearing either a bow tie or a vyshivanka, a traditional Ukrainian embroidered shirt. Arthur's filming crew consists of his 13-year-old sister Sophia and his father.
For our reports that we do, Arthur is the reporter, he's the talent, and Sophia, his sister, is my assistant cameraman, sound technician, and she operates a script manager. And I'm the producer and the director.
Okay.
Arthur's love of journalism started when he was 5. He wanted to become a reporter, just like his dad. His father taught him some basics, and Arthur fell in love with the job. After Russia invaded Ukraine, Arthur wanted to report on only one topic, especially so since his mother is from Ukraine and his grandmother and grandfather live in Kyiv.
My mother is Ukrainian, and I know a lot of Ukrainians, and I was making reports before this, before the invasion happened, on the stand with Ukraine, Russia was building up its military forces. I began reporting on that, and then when the actual invasion happened, I knew I had to do something to help, so I began making reports on that as well.
San Diego, Los Angeles, San Francisco. Arthur's family crew traveled through California, filming protests in support of Ukraine and interviewing volunteers working with refugees. Recently, Arthur's father came back from Hostomel and Bucha, where he was filming and reporting for work.
I've been working with the state emergency services, with the first responders, documenting their dangerous work in this time of war. The demining activities.
Sophia says her life changed after the war started.
I really feel like I have a deep responsibility to protect Ukraine in any way I can.
The family's goal is to keep attracting attention to the ongoing war in Ukraine, especially since the international community's focus is appearing to fade as the war drags on. For Kristina Shevchenko in Los Angeles, California, Anna Rice, VOA News.
That brings us to the end of today's program. There's more VOA coverage of Ukraine 24 hours a day on our website, voanews.com, and on our social media platforms, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. On behalf of the Flashpoint Ukraine team, thank you for listening. I'm Michael Lippin. Good night from Washington.
Of America, Washington, D.C.